Sinds begin 50er jaren is Tibet van grote aantrekkingskracht geweest voor filmmakers. Henry Gouw was een van de eerste westerlingen die filmbeelden vastlegde van de Dalai Lama en de cultuur van Tibet. Later werd Tibet door Hollywood ontdekt. Het verhaal van Henry Gouw werd vastgelegd in de film van Jean-Jacques Annaud, Seven Years in Tibet, met Brad Pitt in de hoofdrol. Bertolucci maakte Little Buddha. En Martin Scorsese maakte het levensverhaal van de Dalai Lama Kundun. Na de golf van Hollywoodfilms over Tibet ontstond er een nieuwe categorie van speelfilms. Deze keer niet gemaakt door westerlingen, maar door mensen die zelf uit de Tibetaanse cultuur afkomstig waren. Een van deze jonge Tibetanen is Nathan Shirling Rinpoche. Hij is abt van een klooster in India. Zijn speelfilmdebuut is gebaseerd op het levensverhaal van de Tibetaanse yogi Milarepa.
Milarepa is that one of the greatest yogi in Tibet, and text him in 11th century. Of course, there's so many yogis in Tibet, but Milarepa is one of the all the schools they respect. It's like almost like non-sectarians that everybody respects. He born into a really rich family, mm-hmm. and when he was 7 years old, his father is passed away. And before his father is passed away, and he father tell his uncle and auntie that please take care of my son and the daughter and the wife until my son is become big, and then he can take care of himself. And then he passed away, and then after that, uncle and auntie took over everything, their wealth, and they never give it back. And on top of that, they make them like a slave, and they work for uncle and auntie for day and night, and you know, life has become so miserable. And then Milarepa has become like 17, 18 years old, and then mother asked uncle and auntie to give back their wealth, because now my son is grow up, he can take care of himself. Then mother is very upset, and then mother really wants revenge. And then mother sent his son to learn sorcery. This is the only way to they can take the revenge, otherwise they don't have any no other way to take revenge. So he sent him to learn the sorcery, bulk magic, and then son went, he went to learn bulk magic, and then he learned sorcery. And then he killed like 35 people, all the uncle's son, and also uncle's wife and uncle's son's wife and everything. So then he took the revenge, and then he thought he solved all the problems. He thought he's going to be really happy. Then he realized that it's actually he make more enemies because of all the people, all the villagers, they become really angry, and they all become his enemy. So then he realized that this is not the right way. and then he really wants something else in different paths. Then he found the spiritual path. In these days, everybody, you know, killing each other and making war and taking revenge. So Melarepa also does the same thing, and he takes the revenge, he kills lots of people. Difference is that he realized in the end that revenge is not good, is not the solution to the solving problems. It's not a solution to solving problems. So I think that's why people can relate it to their situation in these days. And I think it's really helpful for them. Then he achieved the enlightenment in one lifetime. So that is very, very inspiring for everybody, I think. Inspiring for normal people because of the everybody does the mistake. And even though you does the mistake, still you can change into a better person. You have the hope. It gives hope for everybody.
Filmmakers Ritu Sarin uit India en haar Tibetaanse partner Tenzin Sonam produceerden eerder talloze documentaires over Tibetaanse cultuur. Hun eerste speelfilm Dreaming Lhasa is een eigentijdse weergave van jonge Tibetanen die in ballingschap opgegroeid zijn, die op zoek zijn naar hun culturele identiteit.
What we tried to do in Dreaming Lhasa is we tried to have characters that were very real, and so we have a character called Jigme, who's a young musician in Dharamsala, and you know, he's there kind of partying and playing music and smoking dope, very much like the young people in Dharamsala do. And this is something we normally wouldn't see of Tibetans. You know, they don't do that kind of stuff. I mean, they're very, very holy, right? So we have our characters that we've shown in our film are alternate characters that I think haven't been seen in the Tibetan cinema or in foreign cinema about Tibet. The thing with Karma is that she is American, but you know, of Tibetan origin, and she's confused about her identity, so she's very much searching for her roots. And in the film, she sort of guides us into the film if we are a Western or an outside person, because she's an outsider. And through her eyes, you know, she has this relationship with Jigme, who's the local boy, but there's also Tundup, who's the man who's come from Tibet, who's the real Tibetan, you know. So the person from exile can't compare with the real Tibetan, because the real Tibetan has fought the Chinese and he had been a monk, and he has a mystery and a quality about him that's fascinating for her. So the you know, there's the conflict between the two, the ones who are from Tibet and the ones who are in exile.
In exile, Tibetans like us, you know, most of whom have never seen Tibet, for us, like, Tibet is, you know, on the one hand, we kind of think we're part of Tibet, but then on the other hand, when these Tibetans from Tibet come out, we can't relate to them. They're, like, kind of totally different, you know. So some of us kind of think, like, well, maybe they're the real Tibetans, because they've been in Tibet, they've fought the Chinese. And we, what have we done? We've just, like, lived in a foreign country all our lives. We don't know anything about Tibet. So there's this strange kind of attitude towards Tibetans from Tibet. A mixed attitude, yeah.
예미 캐나 생 말해.
예미 그도 과르시네지. 아 지난 기운이 게임도. 그럼 나 캐나 편할 야 중요 요 말로 캐나 게 챙기 말해.
그래. 앞에도 더 많이.
아니 나 편할 게 그래. 게미 연애래, 게미 매네래. 내 남편으로 봐.
얘네 미창만 수용도와. 캐나 가진의 발로니아 더우도.
바로고요.
이네 내가 되나? 교육이 돈다 나게 망하자 두고로와. 같이 내대기매. 찍지나? 아리라 이용 두고래. 니 로고 치고.
As a Tibetan, we grew up feeling completely Tibetan. But we were born in India, we grew up in India. We never felt Indian, although that was the only country that we actually knew. And most of us had never seen Tibet. So this idea of this country that we belong to was kind of mythical, almost. And so that, especially two generations later, I think that kind of creates a very strange kind of a people with in a very strange place, you know. I mean, neither here nor there. And that's something that always interested me. And I felt it was important to reflect on that. So in a sense, Dreaming Lhasa, I think the main point or the main subject that we're trying to explore is really the question of identity and what it means to be an exile. There is this kind of mythification of Tibet, this Shangri-La kind of image of Tibet, which, you know, is very popular. And I think it feeds into a certain need in the West. And that's the reason why it exists, because it's a projection of what the Western kind of mind wants, you know. So they've created this kind of image. And the kind of the strange thing is Tibetans themselves now have come to believe this myth about themselves, you know, because it's been kind of like pointed out to them, or it's been like kind of repeated to them so many times that they think, yes, that's how we are. We're kind of like special, you know, people. And I really feel that's dangerous. And so in our work, we've really tried to present a Tibet that's more real, more down to earth. I mean, Tibet is a Buddhist society. Buddhism is very much a part of Tibetan culture. But there are all kinds of other things as well that's happening within the community and the culture. So we've, you know, tried to present that. I think a lot of Tibetans get a very rude shock when they kind of, say, immigrate to America. And suddenly they're kind of working in a, you know, restaurant as a dishwasher. And nobody cares, you know, whether you're a Tibetan or, you know, a Salvadorian, you know, you're all the same. And suddenly it hits them like, hey, like, you know, what's happened to all these people who kind of always told us how great we were? You know, it's not true. So I think it's... it has many dangers.
And I think it's also because the Dalai Lama has such a presence in the world. So people think they're, you know, a bit like him. You know, they believe that some people, a bit like him in the sense, they have some of the same qualities.
You know, the more I learn about Tibet, the more I feel like a complete stranger.
You can't say that, Karma. I am Tibetan, you are Tibetan, and we all are Tibetan.
But there's a difference.
Yeah, I think this idea of people living in two places, not being connected to any one reality or any one history or tradition, I think it affects so many people, especially in the modern urban kind of metros in the world. And when we've shown our film, we've had a response from a lot of people, like, will come up and say, you know, maybe they're Asians or, you know, Vietnamese in Toronto. And they'll come up and say, I really feel that they're talking about my life, you know? And that's the character of Karma, who's the American, basically brought up in America, Tibetan girl. They really relate to her. So I think we all, you know, are in that sort of confused world now because nothing is clear.
But I think for Tibetans, what's different and what's important is that we have a political... purpose to our being refugees. I mean, we came into exile because the Chinese took over Tibet. And the point of our remaining in exile was really to fight for Tibet's freedom. So in the back of our lives is this kind of big political goal that, you know, that we've had to live with. I mean, His Holiness is now, you know, past 70. And we hope he'll live a very long life, but nonetheless, we have to think, you know, if things are not resolved while he's still alive, then what happens to the Tibetan cause? You know, because at the moment, it's really because of him that the Tibetan cause even has any visibility, you know, internationally. So, yeah, I think it's a time when we Tibetans have to really start contemplating and thinking about the future and how, you know, what direction our movement should take. In the last 20 years or so, there has been a revival of Buddhism in Tibet. And I mean, Ritu and I traveled to Tibet in 1995 once, and then last year again. And we were amazed to see that despite the fact that there were so many Chinese people in Tibet, the Tibetan identity as a people seemed as strong as ever. And part of that, I think, is due to the fact that there's a very strong revival of Buddhism taking place in Tibet. Now, the Chinese are obviously controlling many aspects of this Buddhist revival. As you know, the Dalai Lama is completely banned. You're not even allowed to have a photograph of the Dalai Lama there. So at a certain level, they're trying to control it. But on another level, I mean, they cannot control it.
Tijdens het maken van de film Little Buddha kwamen twee jonge Tibetanen in aanraking met het medium film omdat zij als adviseurs waren aangesteld voor Bertolucci. Een van de jonge Tibetanen is Dzongsa Khyentse Rinpoche. Bekend over de hele wereld als boeddhistische leraar, besloot hij film te gaan studeren in New York. Wij vroegen Dzongsa Khyentse naar de relatie tussen boeddhisme en film.
As a filmmaker and as a Buddhist, I can see there's a lot of similarity. In film and in some of the Buddhist teachings, you know, in one way, of course. You know, the film, you have all this footage, and then you would edit, then you would put sound. And basically, it makes the audience believe there's a real time, real event. And better you do it, more successful your film is. Now, but we have a control over the film before we make it, sort of. We can edit. Life is same. Our life, we direct, we produce, we are our own audience, we make our own music. But we forget to edit a lot. We have so much sort of garbage, sort of wasted footage. We should edit much better than what we are editing. And by doing meditation, that's what we are supposed to do. When we go to the film, no matter how great the film is, when the film ends, then you go out of the cinema. And why? Because you know, of course you have cried, you have felt bad, you have felt emotional, all of that, but at the end of the film you go out. This life film that we have, we never go out, even though it is just like a film. And this is because we don't know the otherwise. And this is what we have to know, the otherwise situation.
You have to be able to get out of the film.
Yes. Or at least we have to know this is film. Then you have a courage to go out.
And how do you do that?
Well, actually by realizing that, as we talked earlier, this is only our perception. This is only my mind doing this. For instance, if you are looking at a beautiful girl, the moment you see she as a beautiful, your passion, your desire is projecting it. So there's this projector. And then you see that. And I can prove you this because this same beautiful girl, you might end up chatting with her, dating with her, engagement, marriage, 2 years, you are bored with her. Then you begin to see her as ugly, not so nice, even makes you angry. Look at here, perception working again. Now, if you can reflect on these things, then you will begin to release this strong grip towards life as real.
And why is it so important to release the grip?
Because otherwise we will always be intense. We are always deceiving ourselves. We are always insecure. So much anxiety, so much suffering.
Yeah, Buddhism is always talk about that everything is illusion and projection by the mind. And example, Buddhism saying that nothing is solid outside, it's all projection from the inside. If it's solid outside, if something is really solid outside, then it should be always the same, but it's not. Example like something like water. We see water as drinking water or the cleaning or take a shower. And example like who lives inside the water and their things is water is like their home. So actually it's the same, but it's from different point of view, it's different totally. So that's why example like this, so it's actually coming from our projection, from the mind. When I was young, my teacher in disturbing me from the watching a movie, and they said, "Oh, don't watch movie. You know, movie is really bad influence. Is the things movie is all about killing and you know, and all those things." So I thought if movie can influence the bad way, then definitely we can influence the good way. So I thought, even though I grew up in the monastery and my job is that in the monastery, in Lama, so I'm thinking that the movie making is also part of my job, part of my spiritual job.
We look at something, a beautiful object, and when we see this is beautiful, we forget this is what you see. We instead think this is what it is. So we always sort of mingle it together. And okay, you, for instance, you are in the desert, then you see a mirage. You think this is water. You forget that this is a mirage. And this is what happens. When we use the word illusion, we despise, oh, this is illusion, right? But for the Buddhist philosophy, everything is illusion. There is nothing that is not illusion. You do not really despise the illusion. You dwell in it. You can make use of it. You see, illusion, if you know it is illusion, and then if you go there, as I was saying earlier, if you know it is a trap, knowing it is a trap and you go there is a less suffering or no suffering at all.